It's not a problem to understand it. So you just have to know, can I do this? Can I do that? You have to ask the right person what you have to do. And after you do, because the most advanced yogis are people who don't understand anything anymore.
Yoga is one of the oldest physical activities. The word yoga comes from Sanskrit and means to unite, in the sense of uniting body and mind. For some people, yoga means a deep stretching of the body. For others, it is a sport. For still others, it is like meditation or a spiritual path. But what does it really mean to practice yoga? In this episode, I talk to yoga teacher Sébastien Dupont about meditation and entering an inner stillness and state of egolessness. Why yoga is not for everyone, mantras, the spiritual path is a struggle, and that a little yoga brings a little relief. This podcast brings you stories from and about people who stepped into the unknown, stories about fear, uncertainty, the illusion of security, or I don't know. Let's see what it will be about. My name is Katarina Bayer, and I will host you on this journey into the unknown. Since more than 25 years, you are practicing yoga for yourself. And I'm interested in why you started to do yoga at first. And when did you decide to not only do yoga privately, but also become a teacher?
It's a good question. And if I remember the first contact with, not directly with yoga, but with spirituality was when I was about 14. I was reading already about meditation, and I remember I was going to the book store, and I was buying some books with my parents about meditation. So it has always been interesting for me, this topic of meditation. And only a few years after, when I was 16, 17, I wanted to do something for my body also. Because I was a teenager, I didn't feel very good with my body, and I wanted something more physical and related to spirituality also. I was doing some martial art at school, like everybody, and it was not my... I felt that it was not really the way I wanted to take. And then I discovered, again, through books, because I was only 16, there were no yoga classes for me, or I didn't know. And I started yoga with the books of André van Lisbeth. I don't know if you heard about André van Lisbeth. It's a Belgian yoga teacher. It's one of the first yoga teachers teaching in the West. And his books are really good and really attractive for a beginner.
That means you started with meditation and you became then, you did practice for yourself. But why did you start to say, okay, now I want to teach others? What happened in your life?
To teach others, it was already 12 years after I started yoga. I started when I was 16, maybe 17, I don't know exactly. And I started teaching when I was 28, when I was 28 only. I never wanted to be a yoga teacher, never. For me, I was into music, I was playing, I was teaching. And then I felt like also teaching music. I was teaching solfeggio. You know, it was not especially for me, at least. It was not really what I wanted to do with my life. And I started to give little yoga classes to the students, my colleagues of the conservatory. I was studying in Lyon, the conservatory, and I started to give classes to my colleagues, and they say, "Oh, it's really good the way you teach, and you should do this. It's nice when you teach yoga." And it was, so I finished my studies at the conservatory when I was 28. I got my diploma and I decided to teach yoga and to do only this.
So it was actually something that you didn't plan, but just happened naturally.
Yeah, I definitely didn't plan it. But after, when I decided to teach, I was living next to Geneva at this time. And when I decided to teach, I decided actively to look for students, and it's not so romantic that I didn't decide anything. I decided to teach yoga, and I was looking for a studio to teach. I was teaching. I got some private classes, and that's the way I started teaching yoga.
You know, the word yoga for me, it's really interesting, because when you say yoga to any kind of age, everybody thinks that they know what yoga is. And when I think about yoga, the first thing that pops into my head is this very flexible people, or the I don't know, woman running around in yoga pants, and it's more like this fashionable item. So I was wondering, what is actually yoga? Can you share with us what yoga means?
To me, it's true that people have a very different understanding about what yoga is, and that's a little bit the paradox when you teach in a studio. For instance, you have 20 people in front of you. You have 5 which are interested by the spirituality of yoga. They want to attain meditation. And most of them, some of them want to be stronger, some of them just want to lose kilograms, some of them are stressed. And it may look as a big problem, but in fact it works. I mean, all these people are practicing yoga. Of course, different people will choose different styles of yoga. But if you teach in the right direction, you can bring even people who are really not interested about spirituality to something spiritual, to the breathing exercise, for instance. So to answer your question, is very long, could be very long, but yoga is a spiritual practice from India. It's something spiritual. It depends on which level I want to answer this question, but if I want to answer from the very Indian point of view, there are 4 ways for yoga, which has been detailed by Vivekananda, but it doesn't matter. The first one is karma yoga. Karma yoga is the yoga of action. So it's the yoga of the hands. It's yoga of people who have a lot of duties, a big family, a lot of work, and we are all kind of karma yogis now, because we don't teach to monks. The second way to attain immortality or moksha or freedom is bhakti yoga. And bhakti yoga is very close to religion. It's about prayer. There is no question of asana, of posture in these both two first types of yoga. One is about doing your work in a special state of mind. I will not enter into the details on this. Second one is the prayer and devotion. It's the way of the heart, way of love. Third one is jnana yoga. Jnana is the way of the brain, understanding, and that understanding who I am, and that understanding ultimately that everything is one, and there is no me, there is no you, there is no difference. That's jnana yoga. So we have the three first ways, the way of the hand, the way of the heart, the way of the brain. And the last one is called Raja Yoga. Raja Yoga is the royal yoga, is the way of controlling the mind. Because when you do your action perfectly, karma yoga, there is no ego. When you love God with your whole heart, there is no ego. When you understand perfectly who you are, there is no ego. And when you control your mind, it means when you are able to make your mind totally quiet and silent, there is no ego. So the last one that we call Raja Yoga is containing, in a way, Hatha Yoga. Hatha Yoga is a branch of Raja Yoga. It's a way to control the mind. And in Hatha Yoga, we use the body. We use the body positions, many asana, many positions and breathing exercises. So that's the way of union or unity through the body and the breath, the control of the body and the breath and the control of the mind. That's contained in Raja Yoga, the fourth different, the fourth method, the fourth way to freedom.
I tried to summarize it for me. So yoga is unifying body awareness and mind. And what you said, what I really thought it's interesting, and you once even said it in different words in a yoga class that I attended, was that the poses prepare you for meditation and the breathing also for meditation. And the aim is to have like a ego-less state. Is this right?
It's absolutely like this. We have to remember that anything we do in a yoga class, in the yoga class that is really turned in the right direction, is in order to not to reach meditation, but to be reached by meditation. So how to free the inner space, to free enough inner space into our body, into our breath, into our mind, to create that vacuum that will attract meditation. Maybe it's like this. We can say it like this in a way. We can explain it in other ways. But it's a kind of cleaning. So you clean the body, you clean your breath, you clean your mind. There are also techniques of concentration, for instance, when you look at a flame of a candle. And when everything is clean, when everything is really empty, ready, relaxed, then there is an opening for something else. And as soon as there is this opening, this something else can come.
So you try to reach an empty state, that's something that you don't know what will come enters the state.
Yeah, but as soon as, it's just words, but as soon as you say, I try to reach one state, it means you want to take yourself in that state. And the yourself is what you have to quit to let this state happen.
I think this is the hard thing for me because, you know, I tried meditation so many times and first I started with mantras to keep my mind busy because I was always in my mind when I was sitting. And I still do the same when I'm unsure or when I'm afraid, then I'm saying things to myself because it feels for me safe. And sometimes I reached this point where I felt like, oh, there was this the silent that you were talking about. But I actually, it is so hard for me to finally fully let go of the head and of the mind. How can I really practice this and why should I do it? I mean, when you say you have an empty state and then maybe something can enter, I don't know if this is already enough, you know, pleasure for me to give it a try.
Exactly. Not everybody wants this. And we are not all made for meditation. The problem is that in our modern world, everybody has access to everything. But when you read the traditional yoga text, it's written many, many times everywhere that this is a secret. This is just for a real student, sadhaka, and a real, which have a disciple. It has to be taught by the master. It doesn't have to be given to everybody. So in a way, it's good to make it more democratic and to give this knowledge to everybody because maybe more people will be serious, but serious in this. I mean, you can be serious with something else. But what I want to say is that this is the sage say sometimes that this is the natural state. And this is very important to understand it in a proper way. The natural state, this inner silence, and this removing totally of the ego, is a natural state, not in the sense of nature, like the trees, the birds, the dogs, the cows. No, this is not the way the animal live. And this is not the way probably we are programmed genetically to live. That's why the sage, if you study the life of the great sage, like Ramana Maharshi, Ramakrishna, Mananda Moyi, none of them had children. And if everybody lived like them, the world would disappear, the human race would disappear in 50 years. So, in 100 years. So this natural state is not the biological state. Normally, a human being doesn't have to stop thinking. Maybe we in the modern world, we are thinking too much, definitely. But it doesn't mean that the people who live in a natural place, they are not thinking all the time. And probably everybody is thinking nonstop the whole life from the birth to death. And it's all right. It's all right. It's the biological life. But it's not what the sages talk about when they speak about natural state. They speak, I thought a lot about this formula, natural state. They speak about the state like the state of the universe. If you look at the universe, you will see many, many things. Many stars, many planets, many clouds, big clouds, strange things, meteorites, etc., etc. And just in a few little space, maybe just in our planet, maybe in a few planets, just very, very, and in a very, very small scale of temperature also. If you go to the North Pole and to the South Pole, there is not what we call life, or almost not. And so this biological life is just a very, very tiny part of the universe. So probably if you think about the whole, when the sage say this is the natural state of the whole, it included much more things than just biological life. One visitor one time said to Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, I don't know if you know Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj,
no.
The great saint, and yeah, I will tell about him maybe another time if you invite me again. And a visitor said, but the happiness you propose us is the happiness of the stones. The happiness of the stones. And Nisargadatta Maharaj, he answered, what is wrong with stones?
I assume that you have a lot of moments in your life that are without ego, because you practice yoga a lot, you give lessons, so you are often in an egoless state. Is this correct?
I will answer very honestly to your question, because it's easy to cheat people and to say something which is not totally correct. On one side, I have moments where I experience deep meditation. I try to answer to this question without ego and without lying. For instance, this night during my sleep, I had a very deep, there have been very deep moments of meditation, very, very deep. Now, during the day, I have a family, I have a lot of things at home happening, I have to deal with many things. And this for daily life, I'm not always in samadhi, of course, because it's impossible to. And I'm not also in the state of samadhi that we call sabija samadhi or savikalpa samadhi, where the sage is also active, but at the same time he's merged in the absolute. No, I'm not in this state. But during the day, what I do and what I can advise people to do is to use yama niyama. You know yama niyama?
No.
Yama niyama is the rules of yoga about how to deal with daily life, what you have to do and what you have to avoid. And this should be our guideline for our daily life, this yama niyama.
Can you share some of these guidelines?
It's very, very simple. It looks very simple. For instance, asteya, not stealing. Satya, truth, the truth. But that's what I try to do answering your question. Not to pose like a great sage, absolutely not. Aparigraha. Aparigraha is not to accumulate a lot of things. Aparigraha. Brahmacharya. Brahmacharya is to master our sexual impulse, to master our sexual life, to be the master of our sexual life and not to be the slave of our impulsions or instincts. This is Brahmacharya. And so on. There are many yama niyama. It's very interesting to study. There are five yama in the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali and ten yama in the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, for instance. So this is, I could speak about this for a very long time, but maybe you don't have so much time.
I would have so much time, but my thoughts are running in my head because I really thought, and I'm very happy that you said you're honest. You have your moments without ego in deep meditations, but in a daily life, it's not always possible.
In daily life, we try to do our best.
This is what I was struggling. I had these moments and I enjoyed them. I felt very peaceful and calm, and then life hit me again.
Yeah.
And I was like, how do others do it? And it's nice to know that you also...
I can go even further on this story of ego. Ego is not a mistake of the nature. Ego is not something bad that you have to remove. Ego is something very necessary for daily life, for biological life. Ego is here so that you want to protect your body first, your family first, and you want to have desire for the opposite sex, and you want to make children, to make a family. Ego is all this. You want to eat. You're hungry. You want to eat. You want to feed your children. You want to take care of your husband or your boyfriend more than the boyfriend of somebody else. It's not dirty. It's not bad. It's absolutely adapted to the biological life. So we don't have to feel guilty because we have an ego. It's absolutely normal. This illusion, the sage, this is an illusion. You are not separated from the rest of the world. But to feel separated is very useful in biological life. If somebody aggress my son, I will do something. Maybe I will fight with him. You're like an animal. Or I want to fight. It's not bad because after he will leave my son alone.
What does yoga, what is one of the oldest physical activity, bring or offer for the Western world that we can actually use, not being a monk and meditate the whole day, but what is like your five main things that it can offer to us?
Yeah, it's a very good question. If you think that yoga is something extremely serious, and if you read Hatha Yoga Pradipika, it's written that you have to live in a little place, secluded place to get arms, to buy your food, etc. But this is game over for us. So we stop. We don't practice yoga at all. But if you go to India, even for a very long time, you will see that even in India, in some families, many families, they practice a little bit of yoga, a little bit of pranayama, a little bit of yoga. So the very good news is that a little bit of yoga brings a little bit of relief because it takes you a little bit in the direction of, because these tensions happen when the ego is too strong, really too strong, when it's frustrated or when there's something wrong. So yoga is bringing a little, it's like when you look at the sky, you look at the stars and you feel suddenly a little bit better because all your little problems, you see, there is all these things. Okay, you cannot go to the stars. You will never go to the stars. It's too far. But the fact that you see them, you can already breathe a little bit more because this is the truth. There is all this stuff around. We are nothing compared to this immensity.
So it shares with us a little glimpse of what is possible.
Yeah, and it's also an invitation to practice more if you want to feel more. After, I don't want to say that the progress is a line. The more you practice, the more you... No, sometimes you remove a little bit of ego and you find back some things from your childhood which are shaking your your personality, and you feel better before when you had a lot of friends making parties. It was more stable, you know. And now you start to look a little bit inside also, to look at your ego, how it works, and then you have a lot of things coming at the surface. So it can be also painful sometimes. It's not a very quiet trip. The spiritual way is a struggle.
Imagine I would be an old friend of you back in France, and I would have, now we meet again after 15 years, and I would know nothing about what happened in your life. What do you think would be the major things that I would see how you changed and developed?
In 15 years.
Yeah, in the last 15 years.
I would say it's a good scale of time to judge progression. From 1 year to the other, it's... it's already difficult to see a big change because, you know, as me, that the years are going very fast and faster in our perception. So what I can say compared to 15 years ago, let's take 15 years. So, yeah, I'm a bit more than 40. If you took me 25, I think the reactions to situations that I didn't imagine like this is much more flexible. The reaction to people who speak to me not the way I would have expected, for instance, or the changing in my schedule, or the facing this is easier now than 15 years ago, much easier. After, I don't want to speak about experiences of meditation because they happen and after they disappear and after they happen again and in different form. It's very difficult to judge. And it's not the most important. Many people think when you practice yoga, you judge your progression at the number of time you have an experience of meditation or samadhi or kundalini or all this stuff. It doesn't prove anything. But when you see, that's why I was speaking about yama niyama. When you see that you made progress in yama niyama, in respecting the rules, and it's easier for you, it's not painful to respect the rules, like the rules for driving a car. So when you are more quiet, it's easy to respect the rules. When you are very angry or very stressed, you tend to make something forbidden, to do something forbidden because you are in a hurry, because you are nervous. Because, yeah, I would answer like this. More flexibility. I don't speak about the body. After 40 years old, you will not get much more flexibility. It's very good. It's very good when it's over. All these things which stick you to your body. So it's good to practice.
Would you also say that it's easier for you to face uncertainty and things that just happen and how you respond to the not knowing?
That's exactly what I mean. How you face the things that you don't know, and the fact that you don't know what will happen also. This simple fact is difficult to face because we want to feel safe. And yoga tells you that the part of you that wants to feel safe will never be safe. The ego wants to feel safe, the ego will never be safe. It's always strengthening, it's always, it will disappear at the end. So the ego knows that it has to struggle nonstop. The solution is not to struggle against the ego, which is himself, struggling. It's to realize your own nature, which is much more than this.
Preparing this interview, I tried to find out some things about yoga and ancient texts. Mm-hmm. And what I found is that yoga is all about being in the present moment. And some of the ancient texts says that past and future are just ideas of our mind. And if you live in this, it's all about suffering. And I can combine this very much with stretching your own limits, because when I was doing the downward facing dog for the first time, the yoga teacher said, like, this is a resting position. I thought I'd never reach that state when I think downward facing dog is a resting position. And now for me, downward facing dog, and even I'm not practicing yoga on a daily basis, is a resting position. So I was wondering if this also can happen, you know, metaphorically, that even now for me, past and present, past and future is really important, but maybe it gives me the chance to relax into the present more. You know, that flexibility in the body also makes flexibility in the mind after all.
It has to, and that's what we have to look for when we practice, flexibility of the body. And it's a lot of questions. There are two questions in one. The limits of our body that we stretch and after the present moment. I know that for you it's related in your question, but I try to dissociate again the two questions. It's true that I was explaining maybe yesterday in a class that the The progression of yoga asana in the postures, I speak only about the posture, is when you, at the beginning, you feel comfortable in 10% of the postures, and after 20, and after 30, and after 80, and after 90, 95, because some postures are really, really require big effort. This is a very good way to judge your progression in the posture. It means you bring some a little bit of spirituality, a little bit of relief in the positions. That's a very good sign. It's not only the sign that your body is making progress; it's also the sign that you are more able to breathe deeply in difficult physical situations. It's not automatically that because you are able to breathe deeply in more different positions, you will be able to stay quiet in all the situations of life. It's not so closely connected. You have to practice pranayama. Pranayama is the link between the body and the mind. If you don't use, you cut this link, you say, okay, I practice just postures, I breathe deeply in the pose and it's enough, and that's pranayama. No, that's not pranayama. It's not absolutely not pranayama. Pranayama is I sit down, and then there are special exercises, a lot, and very, it's a big tradition, very, very important, because it's the link between the body and the mind. If you don't use this link, then the tool, especially when you would get used, first time you feel this in downward facing dog, you will think it's fantastic, I'm able to feel good, and the next time you will already start to think, oh, what I will eat after the class. Because you feel good, your mind will feel more freedom. You will immediately fill this empty state with thoughts. Immediately. I would say unfortunately, but no, it's not unfortunately. It's nature. It's biology. It's like this.
And the second part of the question, will you also answer this? Now I'm curious.
But let's use a little, not a joke, but... The past doesn't exist because it's finished. The future doesn't exist because it doesn't happen. It's just in my imagination. And what about the present moment? What is a moment?
It's already gone when we speak about it, right?
Exactly. You got it.
Yeah.
A moment is like a point. A point has an existence in mathematics, but not in real life. A point has no dimension, no height, no width. Does something like this exist in life? No. There is no point. It doesn't exist a point. Moment doesn't exist. There is no moment. Because as soon as you start to talk moment, the moment is gone. Mm-hmm. So it's just a formula, which is not totally bad. But I want just to attract your attention on the fact that it's really the danger is to is empty talks about this present moment. And also about something else which is interesting is that to look for the moment is to refuse the movement. And if you refuse the movement, think about a river, for instance. There is a boat, it's a very, very strong stream, but there is a stream. You go into the river and you attach, you grab a tree, a branch of a tree, and you say, I will find the present moment. And then you feel the difference between your position and the speed of the river. And it's very difficult. But if you release this branch and you let yourself be carried really peacefully by the river, then there is no difference between the water and yourself. And it's much more relaxing, maybe. Probably. And you don't have to worry if there is a waterfall or no waterfall. So just relax. Probably there is only the ocean, and the ocean is the ocean of meditation.
Yeah. I have nothing to add to this. can you explain me a bit? I was always interested as a yoga student and about mantras. I really like to, after the class, chant mantras together, and I felt how powerful the singing together is. Can you share maybe what mantras are meant to, and maybe you have one that is your favorite one that you want to share with us?
Very deep question, mantra. Mantra, if you take the meaning of the word mantra, it doesn't mean anything interesting. The way for the mind to work, no. But we all know what is mantra, and at the same time, we don't know exactly what it is. Mantra is a sound. And even if I say that mantra is a sound, it's written in traditional Indian texts that the most powerful mantra is without sound in your head, just 10 times or 1,000 times more powerful than if you say the mantra with sound. I don't know from which side to take this, this question, because mantra. Mantra is, I still can say that it's about sound. It can be an inner sound that you repeat in your head, or outer sound where you really actually create some vibration. There are three levels of singing a mantra. The first one is with your voice, with the vibration of the air. The second one is, I think in English, it's with low voice, like if you say like this, Om Namah Shivaya,
Om Namah Shivaya. Like whispering.
Whispering, thank you. When you whisper a mantra, the second way of practicing, say that it's already 100 times more powerful. And if you repeat the mantra just in your head, say that it's even 1,000 times more powerful. So why are we sometimes singing mantras with our voice? It's because when the mind is really agitated and not stable at all, it's sometimes good to use the sound because it's very powerful. Because when the mind is a bit gross, you have to grow. When you have a big gross in Russian, what is that? You hit on it with a hammer.
You mean a nail or what?
A nail, exactly. Yeah. When you have a big nail, you need a big hammer. If you have a very, very small, tiny nail like this, you will not use such a big hammer because you will crush your fingers at the same time. You need a smaller one. So it's like this three ways of practicing mantras. You can alternate also. Mantra is a very good practice. Mantra is the practice of mantra is called japa yoga, or just japa. And the idea of japa is like you, to take again the story of the hammer, it's like to hit a stone with a hammer, but not too strong, just a little bit like this. But you don't hit the stone 10 times, you hit the stone 3 hours a day, for instance, and you don't see any change. Boom, 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 boom. There is no difference. And in fact, inside the structure of the stone, there are little...
Cracks.
Yes, exactly. And you don't see them, but you just keep going. And one time it will be the last hit, the last... and the whole stone is exploding. So this is to hit the ego with the hammer of the mantra that will make the ego ultimately disappear. It's a long process. It has to be very often practiced with the breath. Most of the mantras, you can adapt them to the breath. It's also very powerful. You can even count the duration of the breath in pranayama with the mantra.
So would it make sense that I choose like a certain mantra for a certain period, that this is always hitting the stone? Or what would you recommend?
First, I will tell you a few words about the tradition of the mantra. So traditionally, the mantra is given by the guru under a sheet, a tissue that nobody can see what happens. It's a very, very ancient tradition. It's called diksha. Diksha is the initiation. And the guru is giving to the shishya, to the disciple, the mantra at the ear, whispering. And like this, it's very secret and very powerful. You have one mantra for your whole life and you never change. So this is the tradition about mantra. This is very ancient, but not so ancient like the Veda, because in the Veda, the mantras, they were just pronounced by the priests, performing the puja. But it was not to be repeated the whole day. It's a little bit later in the Indian tradition. Nobody knows exactly yet which year it started to be used like this. But now mantra is like this in the tradition of India. Diksha, initiation, and then you have your mantra for your whole life because the guru knows you or she gives you exactly the mantra that you want. And also the fact that you have total faith in your guru makes the mantra much more powerful because it reminds you of the guru and then it has a special power. So I know your question, it will be, if I don't have a guru, do I have to stop practicing mantra? So I asked this question to an Indian sage when I didn't have my mantra. It was already a long time ago, but I understand the answer. this person, which was Swami Vijayananda in the ashram, he was a disciple of Manandamayi. And he told me, maybe he told me this because it was me, but I heard later that he told also to other people that we can use the Om, because the Om is very, very pure, very neutral, very, very universal. It's the sound of the whole. It's very powerful. It should be the only mantra, because it's at the beginning of each mantra, once you have the Om. But why not everybody use the Om? Because when the mind is very agitated, we need something a bit longer. That's why the Christians, they use long prayer. Also, in India, they use long prayer sometimes. The Mahamrityunjaya mantra or the Gayatri mantra are much longer than the Om. But there is Om at the beginning. If you use only the Om, it's safe. It's safe to use the Om. But it's difficult to capture totally the mind with only the Om.
So are you using mantras in when you're teaching people?
This is a very good question. If you teach, I use the Om. When I train teachers, I teach them all the most popular mantras, all of them. But when I really teach to students, like I have a student that I am teaching every day for many years, and we sing only the Om together. I don't feel ready to give him a mantra. I'm not a guru. I'm not Indian. So you see. But when it's student from the teacher training, then we chant mantra together because it's my job to teach them mantra. But I say, I tell them also the real tradition of mantra. It's not an initiation that I give. It's just how to pronounce correctly. And we have a Sanskrit teacher, Sampada, which is teaching us how to pronounce exactly the mantras because she's Indian. It's okay. But you see, it's a complicated question. Each of your questions is a whole book that we have to write about this.
You see, this is the thing. I thought I have an idea what yoga is, what meditation is, what mantra is, what breathing is. And then I asked these questions like, you know, a small girl just asking out of curiosity. And I really didn't realize how much there is behind it.
Oh, yeah. And if you ask me what is the breath, then we start for another. You can imagine. But this, it shows something. It shows something. It doesn't show that you have to read 100 tons of books about yoga to understand exactly. No. It shows that when you want to understand all these things, which are related to spirituality, it's never ending. So do you really want to understand totally everything about mantras? A lot of great sages like, Ramakrishna, Manandamayi, they have almost not been to school. So it's not a problem not to understand. It's not a problem not to understand. So you just have to know, can I do this? Can I do that? You have to ask the right person what you have to do, and after all you do. Because the most advanced yogis are people who don't understand anything anymore. As soon as you understand it, beginning of the, you are blocking something.
I'm not sure if I want a state where I don't understand anything anymore, but it sounds nice at the same time.
In deep meditation, we don't know anything.
Yeah.
But when we are not in deep meditation, we have to be interested by a lot of things. It's really good. Huh? You have to stay alive and not say nothing is interesting. I do yoga, so life is disgusting. No, we are here. There are a lot of interesting things, but you know that you will never understand totally anything, especially when it's related to spirituality. But even if it's related to a book, if I start to look at the structure of this book with a microscope, I will reach a point where I don't understand what is inside.
I hope my next question is not such a huge question, okay? In the last years or decade, yoga became very, very popular all over the world. And as far as I know, there are more than 100 yoga styles or yoga forms. There's hatha yoga, hot yoga, yoga with crystals. Then there's electric music in yoga, aerial yoga, acro yoga, all these different styles. You as a yoga teacher and somebody who just appears to me as really understands all the backgrounds as well, what do you think about these new movements and new forms? Is it something that is a great development, or is it going too far away from the original yoga?
What I can say is that every yoga style that is using positions of the body, different positions of the body, different breathing exercises, is coming from Hatha Yoga. So all these new styles are extensions or shortenings of Hatha Yoga. What is my understanding of Hatha Yoga is that it's so huge. When you read a Hatha Yoga text and when you see a Hatha Yogis, and you understand that it's so big. There is even devotion in Hatha Yoga. When you read, for instance, Garuda Samhita, there is a little verse about devotion. Say that the Bhakti Marga, the path of devotion is when you have a strong emotion thinking about God, and you have tears in your eyes and hair dressing, and how to say in English, on your head. Cannot happen to me, but maybe to you. Then it's parabhakti. It's the supreme devotion, and it's a very good way to samadhi. So even in the Hatha Yoga text, you have this. And at the end of Hatha Yoga Pradipika, for instance, it's a very, very Vedantic, and it's very close to Jnana Yoga. It say that you are like a big pot, open pot in the ocean, with the water inside and outside. There is no difference between inside and outside. It's a metaphor of the body. There is no border between inside and outside the body. So it's really Jnana. It's really Indian philosophy. So you have breathing exercises in Hatha Yoga. You have positions. You have 100 different meditations. Meditations on the light, meditation on the candle, meditation on the inner sound. You have devotion. You have understanding of the real nature. You have disappearance of the ego at the end. So now you want to create something new about this. Why? The question is why? Is it not fast enough? It's not good enough for you? It's not, you want more fun? It's not fun enough, maybe. So I always saw only bad reasons to create new styles of yoga. The only good reason would be a great, great sage. And again, I would ask myself the question, is it really a great sage? That thing, I did like this, it works, it's more simple, it's more adaptive for you. You do like this. Okay, then we can try. But it's even risky because it would not be a very old tradition, and you don't know if this master is really as great as he pretends to be. So personally, I always thought that there are so many things in Hatha Yoga or in Bhakti Yoga, you can pray. But to create a new style out of Hatha Yoga, but let's speak about Hatha Yoga. To create something new from Hatha Yoga is really... If I were a little bit direct, I would say it's a lack of humility. Before, I was always avoiding speaking like this, but why not if it's revelating?
So this means you only practice Hatha Yoga?
No. At the same time, to stay open-minded, you can go to any yoga class and you will always find something interesting in the way. For instance, if you go to a Vinyasa class, for instance, you can discover a nice transition between two positions that you practice every day. And you say, oh, instead of standing up like an elephant and taking the next pose, I could do like this with the breath, and it's nice. But there is no, it will not lead you faster to freedom or to samadhi. No, this I don't believe. But physically, there can be people who are very clever, like they do in America. They are very clever to find good transitions, good things that look very at the same time, it looks very good and it feels very good. And why not? Why not? Why not? So no new ways to samadhi, to freedom, to wisdom, no. But creative physical things can be funny, and we have to stay open-minded also, and not to, but at the same time to have the background to know what we are doing. I go to vinyasa class, it's not to become a sage. It's to feel good, it's good for the body, it's good for my joints, after I feel good, and there are good conditions, and it's fine.
What I remember now, once I attended, it was the only time I attended a life yoga class with you. It was in Moscow when I was there for work. And you said to me that you actually enjoy being in beginner classes on your own because there you can really relax into the pose and enjoy the pose.
Yeah.
I thought this was very fascinating because I was always like, ah, you have to stretch your limits. And then, and you said the opposite. And this was really something that always stayed with me.
That's a very good thing. That stayed with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, beginner's class. It's very easy to practice more yoga and to develop more your ego. Very easy. It's a trap. It's you have to be very careful to avoid this trap. And I, that's why I spoke about this profusion of different styles. There is the question of horizontality and verticality. If you live vertically, or we are not totally vertical or horizontal, but either you discover new things, always new, always excited, but always at the surface, or you decide that this is okay for me because I'm sure I have the faith that it works. I know what I want, this inner peace, this samadhi, this is really something that makes me a burning desire to my body, to my mind, and then this is the way, because I tried already 100 different ways, I want to follow this way, and maybe this person, but you have to be careful. And then it will be boring, it will be repetitive, it will be dry sometimes, it will be not funny every day, but to go, it's like when you study a music instrument. You say, oh, I want to play like this guy. And you start, and after 2 weeks, you say, what for? What is the use to do this? And then the mind is very good to make you understand that you have to give up or to change, to try something new. No. It's the way to yourself.
In a world full of so many opportunities, isn't it nice to stay with one thing and really deepen it? Yeah.
No, it's very hard as long as you don't feel any reward. As long as you don't feel any reward, it's really dry. And what can help you for this period of time when you don't get anything really good from meditation? It's just an effort that you make. It's to be surrounded by people who share the same interest. It's very basic, but in all the spiritual traditions, there is a notion of community. And you have to not to be alone. It's very, very hard to be alone in general, but in spiritual path, it's the same. We never have to be alone, except in some spiritual, very special ways where you are required by the guru to live alone for. But in fact, you can practice alone in the morning, for instance. But to be alone in the spiritual path is really difficult. You have to have good friends around. And after, at the end, when you reach deep meditation, you are even not alone because you connect with the whole. So this feeling of loneliness, I'm lonely, it doesn't have to be exaggerated. It's painful.
I have 3 last questions.
Let's go.
The first of the 3 last one is, what is your biggest fear?
I'm afraid that sometimes that what I teach or what I try to give to people is not working, or it's not received in a good way, or it doesn't doesn't work. And even this fear is not good, because we should not be afraid of the fruits of our actions. We have to do the best we can, and after to not to be interested by the results. For me, it's very difficult.
Second question. What are you currently doing that you still don't know how it will turn out?
Everything.
Now it's the third question already. What is not a question, but it's something special. Mm-hmm. I have this book here where I put a lot of quotes in that I just liked very much. And what I will do is I will flip through the pages and you will say stop.
Okay.
And then you will comment on the quote that you just accidentally hit.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah. So, okay, I will start and you say stop, wait.
Stop.
So, do you want it to have left or right?
Left.
Left. And there is 1, 2, 3, 4 on the left side. Do you want to have 1, 2, 3, or 4?
No.
It is always the funniest thing because it's written by Yogi Bhajan. And yeah. I think it's only 2 yogis that are in this book and you hit 1. So I love when these things happen. So the quote is the following. If you are willing to look at another person's behavior towards you as a reflection of the state of their relationship with themselves, rather than a statement about your value as a person, then you will, over a period of time, cease to react at all.
Uh-huh. I understood. Yeah, it means that you don't have to take the behavior of the others as something directed toward yourself, because take it personally. And then if you stop taking things personally, of course, it's unactivated something. It's unactivating something which is related to our reactions. Yeah. Yeah, very often. In some situations, we have to repeat to ourselves, don't take it personally. It's really good. It's very simple, but very often we take something incredibly personally, and after we have, oh, but this person is doing it with everybody. Don't worry. Oh, yeah, really? And suddenly we feel better. No, we can do like this from the beginning, because most of the things we face, especially when you practice yoga, you want to be more and more closer and closer to the natural state, the state of the universe, means the state zero, the basic state. So everything you will observe that seems excessive to you, it is actually excessive, because you are in the center. So it's there is nothing to be taken personally. This is the first level of understanding. And second level of understanding, the ego is an illusion, doesn't happen. So as soon as you feel something personally or react personally to what somebody told to you, it's because you still are in the illusion. So it's your fault. It's our responsibility to, if we want to stay on the level of this guy, I will have my revenge and everything. Then it's like animals, and it's even more sticky with human beings, because we have a better memory than animals most of the time, and we are very good to make stories about things. So, it's always a personal reaction is always an illusion at the last level of understanding.
Sébastien, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Katarina. It was a pleasure.
If you like this podcast, please follow me on Facebook at Podcast Into the Unknown, or on Instagram into_the_unknown_podcast. You can listen to this podcast on www.intotheunknown.at, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.